All right, guys. So happy Tuesday, I think. We actually came here at 3 p.m., so I thought class was at 3 p.m., and then I was told that it was at 3:30, so I apologize for being late. Today's class is going to be a little bit of an overview for describing a little bit how chromosomes work, how replication works, and mainly, since I worked a lot on transcription and transcriptional regulation, we look at how those two works, how those are altered in cancer, and what you can do about it, and why that is interesting. If at any point you guys have any questions, just raise your hands. If you don't understand what I say, that's fine, just let me know. And I will give you my email address at the end, so you can send me emails if you need to. So I think you guys have this book still. Is that right? Yes? Good. So I took a bunch of pictures and figures, not too many, from this book. Other stuff that are in there have a reference. So if you do want to go back and look at that, there is a reference to that too. If you cannot find it, just let me know and I will do my best to have that, to get it to you. This is kind of like the general idea of the stuff I'm talking about today. I'm just looking for a pointer.
Let's see if this one works.
Yeah, cool. Feels tacky. All right, so this is the general idea of what we're going to talk about today. So we're going to start... I got too excited. All right. We are going to talk about a little bit of the DNA. We talk about RNA a little, and we're going to talk a little bit about proteins. This process is not a linear process, and for linear, I mean it doesn't always happen that it starts here and ends up here, and you will see why, you will see what I mean, and you will see also there are a bunch of steps in between that can change and alter what the outcome of each one of these steps is. This is, again, a little bit of a bullet point of what I'm talking about, so I'll give you some information about DNA, DNA replication, DNA how that is getting transcribed into RNA, and how RNA then becomes translated into proteins. And this should be a pretty quick class. So DNA, and I guess it's not made of marshmallows. So DNA is a macromolecule. So lots of times in classes or anywhere people ask me, or I ask people, so what's DNA? And they start saying, DNA does this, this, and this. Like, no, what's DNA? DNA is made of this, this, and this. No, what's DNA? DNA is. So that's your answer. DNA is a macromolecule. Then you can add all the other stuff that you want on top of it. It's a double helix. You guys know that. And you can see it over here. This is linearized, and here it's coiled up. And you have mainly four bases, and you have two bonds between A and T, and three between C and G. That's what keeps the two helix together. So if we look a little bit more into that, and we want to look at what the chemistry between the different bases is, you can see here highlighted in the red box that there is a phosphodiester bond that's between the different nucleotides on the same strand, and you have a hydroxyl part over here that connects with the phosphate part of the other sugar that forms the whole bond between the two. And since it's a double helix, or since we have lots of it, you need to pack it up and you need to roll it up all together. And the way you do that by rolling around histones, which allow to keep the chromatin conformation as it should be. So allows it to expose some parts of the DNA or to hide some other parts of the DNA, as we will see in a second. And based on which part is exposed and which part is hidden, we can talk about euchromatin or heterochromatin. The first one is the part that is transcriptionally active, and I think I misspelled this. And the second one is actually heterochromatin. It can be either constitutive, so it's always like that, or it's facultative. So it means that can be activated or closed up depending from the situation. And we will look a little bit into a couple of modifications of the histones that allow you to do that. This is a general overview of the karyotype. and you see that they go from the biggest to the smallest, and the sex chromosomes are a little bit different. But overall, you see that the first ones are the biggest ones with the highest, over here, the highest number of genes and the highest amount of number of base pairs, to the 22nd, which is the one with the lowest number, well, some of the lowest number of genes down here, and follows a pretty strict trend. And if you look at that, there is actually an interesting part in this graph. So look at let's look at chromosome 1, and let's look at chromosome 4. So if you look at chromosome 1, the blue bar is much higher than the purple one, or red, or maroon. And what that indicates is that you have a very high concentration of genes in there. However, over here, if you look at chromosome 4, it means you only have just a few, but in contrast to the number of bases, you have plenty of space where there is nothing. Or those genes are just massive, and that's why they cover up lots of space. But I tend more to believe that there are lots of areas that are not transcribed. What those areas could be regulatory areas, so that means they can promote or repress transcription, but we're going to look into that. But anyway, keep that in mind. That's an interesting thing to remember. Talking about interesting stuff, those are stuff you can discuss at a bar with your friends. There are about 2.10 to the 13 meters of DNA in our bodies. So if you think about 2 to the 9th is a billion, so that would be 20 trillion, is it? Yeah, 20 trillion meters of DNA. And that's a lot. So that is pretty much 73 from the Earth to the Sun and back. So that's a lot. And if we take about a person typing 60 words per minute, 8 hours a day, and 50 years to type the human genome. And to give you another interesting fact about that, have you guys ever heard of the ENCODE project? I'm going to touch on that too. Yes? No? Maybe? I hope not. No. Alright. So, it's a project that studies regulatory elements of the genome, so it tells you what they are, what they do, and they try to define those in healthy cells and in disease. What they have a very interesting picture of the first sequenced human genome, which is a bookshelf, which is about 6 foot tall, or a little bit more than that, about 3 or 4, probably 5 or 6 foot wide too. And it's full of these massive volumes. And these massive volumes are all densely written with the four bases. And that's the content of the one human genome. Now, if you think about the fact that the genome for here, there are probably about 20 people, 30 people, we're all very similar, but we're also very different. So there are lots of differences that make my hair, well, some turn gray and, you know, black, rather than being blonde, rather than, you know, being a guy or a girl, being tall or short. So all of those variations are incorporated in that. And where am I going with this is that the amount of data that have to be stored when you do genomic studies is just massive, but also those informations are all stored into the DNA into a very tightly compacted form of informational storage. So here this is like an overview of what you guys have in your DNA, into everybody's DNA. So there are about 3 billion base pairs and 30,000 genes. About half of those, maybe 20,000, 15 to 20,000, are actively expressed in any given cell, in any given time. If you look at RNA-seq data, I don't know how many of you guys do that, or work with RNA-seq data, or genomic data overall, you will see that you will be able to detect only about maybe 17,000 genes at a time, 18,000 genes at a time. So it means that all the others will be shut off. They are probably not working, or their expression levels are so low that won't influence any pathways, or they're not detectable. So if you look at the difference here of the variety of the proteins, the variety of the classes that of the genes that are transcribed, it tells you how complicated is the network inside each cell that allows a finely tuned mechanism that physiologically keeps us healthy. So if we have all of these DNA wrapped up, tightly coiled, and packed up together, we need something that allows it to stay together. And that's the one of the things to do that is like the telomeres. So what they do, they are caps at the end of the chromosome. So it's like if I take this bottle of water, I close it just to make sure, and I turn it around, there is no water coming up. But if now I loosen this up, or I take it out, I'm not going to turn it now, but what's going to happen, all the water is going to come out. And that's the same thing that happens on the chromosomes. And if you look at these mice, this is a healthy mouse, if you look at the color of the fur, of the skin, of the coat, it's nice and black. There is a certain kind of color in here too, and you see the nose and the paws, but you can't really see those now. This is a healthy mouse, generation 1, so it's the first offspring, and this is the length of the telomere. So the red bars at the end here indicate the length of those. Since those mice are null, so they have the gene that maintains them knocked out, it means that at each generation, they won't be able to reconstitute the telomeres at the end. Therefore, those will become shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and you get down here where you have pretty much none. And if you look down here and look at how the mouse looks, it's all hunched up, it's actually more pale, the fur doesn't look so good. That means that all of those phenotypical effects are caused by the lack of telomeres, therefore by a chromosomal instability. And that means that the mouse is not healthy anymore, there is loss of tissue, it will have problem healing wounds, and so on and so forth. And what happens when the telomeres are not there is that this is a very common process. So you're going to have lots of non-homologous fusion between different chromosomes or different parts of the same chromosome. So let's say you go through mitosis, and now the two chromatids are trying to be pulled into each of the cells, but the fusion point here is not really working well. So instead of being pulled in the middle here or here, you're going to be pulled over here. And now maybe there is another chromosome that had exactly the same problem and is going to fuse to that. And then rinse and repeat, you're going to end up having these overall, over pretty much all the tumor cells. So if you look at a karyotype like this one here of tumor cells, you will not see this. Instead of seeing 23 or 24 pair of chromosomes, you're going to see maybe 40 or 35 or 60. That depends on the tumor you're looking at and depends on how many rearrangements you're going to see. So that tells you the chromosomal instability, it's a key factor on the development of cancer. And we work in a cancer hospital, so when we think about curing somebody, we look at how long the person survives when you give them something, or when you try to predict how long the person is going to survive based on the cancer they have. So this is a Kaplan-Meier plot, and over here you have the percentage of the mice that have no tumor, and down here it tells you how old they are in weeks. And you see, if you think about the generations that we were discussing earlier, so these numbers up here, if you put them here, then you see that those that are the oldest, sorry, the later generations, are actually those that develop cancer much earlier. And that's exactly because this process here of the creation of different chromosomal aberrations happens very commonly, and therefore all the gene functions are altered, all the genes themselves are altered, you're going to end up having fusion transcripts, or those genes are not regulated properly anymore, and your cell is acting up, acquires most likely a proliferative advantage, and grows out, and this is the result. So when I'm going to make a little bit of another step now. So we're talking about how the chromosomes are formed, how DNA is wrapped up into chromosomes, and there are proteins that keep those things together, and those are histones. So those are positively charged proteins, DNA is negatively charged, and by packing up, let's say, a group of histones, and they call histone octamers, we are able to form these units. And those units are formed by two histone H3 and H4 proteins, two H2A and H2B, and then you have the white ones over here that are histone H1. They serve to keep everything together. And you have over here a very nice description of how, a visual description of how the DNA wraps around those and then moves on into the next nucleosome. And just by looking at these, you can appreciate how there are some areas that are accessible and open, like those one here, and some areas that instead are not accessible. So this is much harder for the transcription factor to access. And that means that transcription of stuff up here might happen fairly easily, and transcription stuff up here might happen not as easily. And here's just simply another visual to show you that there is a core of 8 histone molecules, and the DNA wraps around it, and it takes about 150 base pairs to fully wrap around it. And I'm not sure what this is, but if I have it there, all right, it doesn't work. All right, forget about it. So, and I also have mentioned a lot about histone modifications. So histone modifications are alterations or chemical modifications that happen at the histone tails. What do I mean for histone tail? So if this is your protein, your histone protein, there are residues that pop out of them. There are a number of those. This is just an example. And depending from the position, so this is in position 5, position 8, 12, 16, and cases for lysine, you can have chemical modifications here. It can be acetylation, methylation, phosphorylation, sumoylation, methylation, or you said that, whatever. So depending from what happens, that allows a certain conformation of the histones. Therefore, a certain conformation of the histones allow the DNA to be visible or not. Therefore, allows transcription factors to bind or not. Therefore, allows transcription to happen or not. So if you look here, you have histone acetyl transferases. This is what HET stands for. They deposit those acetyl groups on the tails of histones. The chromatin, they call it relaxed, or open, or loose, or whatever you want. And that means that transcription factors now can access there and promote transcription. Now, the opposite of HETs, or histone acetyl transferases, are histone deacetylases. What they do, they take this out. And by taking it out, the chromatin becomes more compacted. And by becoming more compacted, then it's harder for transcription factors and the transcription machinery to access. This is not true in all sites. There are some sites that being acetylated actually correspond to transcription or repression, but those are exceptions. But generally, this is how it looks. And this is to give you an idea of what actually influences gene expression. You have a number of genes that influence histone variations, a number of genes that influence DNA methylation. I think you guys have a class about that. And a bunch of genes that regulate how nucleosomes are positioned on the DNA. And all of those things together are influencing the output, which in this case is gene expression. This is another example of what it looks in normal cells and what in normal cells and what it looks in cancer. So if you look at the blue and green dots over here, so we talk about this is a random cell and random chromosome, and you have a certain pattern of acetylation of your histones. You have some K9, K5, and so on and so forth. And you have a certain pattern of methylation, in this case in K4 too. So what is going to happen in cancer cell, this pattern here, this picture that you have, is actually not the same anymore. So things that were acetylated before, they're not acetylated here anymore. And things that were methylated before, they're not methylated here anymore. Now, each one of those numbers that corresponds to a specific location on a specific histone has a specific function. And they all have a combinatorial function, all work together. Like if you look at this institute, it doesn't work because one person works. It works because everybody works together. And here is exactly the same thing. By changing of the pattern of the methylation or the alteration on these cells, change the way all of those regions interact. Therefore, it changes the way in which genes are transcribed. So, we're talking about now gene replication. So, all of those things I mentioned are based on gene transcription, but even before that happens, we have DNA replication. So you, I think that this is very general. You guys know this already, and you know, these are the cell cycle, G1, SNG2, cells keep going through there, and theoretically there are checkpoints where if something happens, the cell goes in apoptosis or fixes the problem or doesn't carry on in, basically doesn't carry on with the cell cycle. And when we look at DNA replication, we have to think that we still have something on this double helix, and you have something in these on two strands. And that means that whatever is reading what's written in there has to access it first. So if I'm holding something between my hands, if I don't do that, there's nothing I can get in there. So what happens, you got this bubble forming. This is a replication bubble, and you have a number of primers and factors that bind. I'm going to show you what they are. We have an enzyme called DNA helicase that opens this up and promotes then the synthesis of the complementary strand. So one of the issues though is that with those complementary strands are read in different directions because they are written 5 prime to 3 prime and 3 prime to 5 prime, otherwise it wouldn't be complementary. Therefore, we need something that creates the lagging, the synthesis of the new strand and allows it to happen while the other one just keeps going linearly. So those things are called Okazaki fragments. And are those green bars over here? Those are RNA primers, about anywhere from 100 to 200 base pairs, depending from where they're binding. You have a DNA polymerase that at some point fills up the region between two of those, and then since there is still a gap in here, you will have a DNA ligase that binds those two together and forms a single strand. In the way, if this one was here at the beginning and then moves this direction, you will have this one first, then this one, then this one, then this one, and so on and so forth. And then you will have a ligase that comes in and binds this one, this one, this one, all together, so you have only one strand. And this one is the easiest one because it's just going one direction. However, as you know, this is a semi-conservative process, which means that when you have an original strand here, you only inherit half of it. And from this half, if you go two generations down, you inherit half and a half. So out of the four strands, you will have two of those that contain half and half from the original one, and then two of those that will contain the new one. So, last year I was so happy because I had all of these videos working and you didn't have to listen to me for an hour and a half. But let's see if I can have this work. Nope. Yeah, it was a nice video about DNA replication. All right, so let's look a little bit at lingo. So when we describe a process, a biological process, it's very important to use a correct terminology because otherwise different words can indicate different things. I just come from a meeting with a group of ontologists, and what they do, they find semantic ways, they build semantic ways in which you can describe biological processes. Everybody here probably heard of genontology, right? Raise your hand if you heard of genontology. No? Yes. Right. So all of those is a description of terms that allow you to understand, for example, what your genes do. If you have a list of differentially expressed genes from study, they tell you what the genes do inside yourself. And it's a very strict way of looking at terms that can describe pathways, they can describe functions, they can describe different things. So if you use the wrong word in there, then it means that your genes might do something completely different from what they actually do. And here's the same thing, maybe not at that level. So anyway, what's a replicon? A replicon is a region where the DNA replication happens, surprise. And it's formed by an origin of replication and an end of it, so it's called terminus. And each chromosome, since those chromosomes are pretty big, have several of those inside, and therefore they will all converge into one at the end. Replication ends at a telomeric region. What happens, those telomeres are shortened each time, offspring. And if you pay attention, you remember that when I showed you the mice, there were different generations with the knockout, telomerase knockout mice. All of those have shorter and shorter and shorter telomerases. And therefore, a cell can replicate just a limited number of times. And here it goes back again at the knockout mice. After that, cells die. However, you know, we went through some numbers. So you have about 3 billion bases, 30,000 genes, bunch of chromosomes, bunch of genes being expressed, transcribed, cells replicating. And there are lots of mistakes happening. It does happen. And what happens is that there is a rate of about 1 to 10,000 base pairs that actually is not correct. And the proofread by itself corrects about 99% of the mismatches, but we still have a 1 in 10 million rate errors. Now, that might not be a high number. However, think about how many times cells replicate in your body each day. Maybe even epithelial cells like intestine, mouth, and so on. And think about how much DNA you have in there. Now multiply the number by the number of cells, by the number of division, by the number of errors. And you'll find out that can be a significant number. So we do have a mechanism that works fairly well. And as you can see, you have, let's say, a mistake over here when you have the new strand being synthesized. And you have a proofread that goes back, cuts it out, fixes it, and makes the correction. And if we do have a mutated pol 2, that's actually the subtype, the pol delta gene, that takes care of the excision repair of fixing those pol mutations. You do notice that you mice with that have a shorter survival too. So that's another key mechanism, key gene that can have a very strong phenotypical effect. And as you can see, you need homozygous mice to do that, because heterozygous mice pretty much are the same as wild-type mice. The meaning that there is no effect, there is a big compensatory effect by the other allele. So there is also a mismatch repair system where you have two proteins, the MSH2 and H6, that recognize the mistake over here, this bump that you can see. They call up other proteins, so they recruit other two proteins involved with that and a whole complex, and that allows to detect errors in the DNA that is being copied. In case you actually have a defect into any of those genes, then in humans you develop a disease called xeroderma pigmentosum. And if you look at this cumulative plot, those people have a higher incidence of skin cancer or squamous cell carcinoma, because there's basically no DNA repair mechanism. And you walk outside, maybe not in Buffalo, but you are exposed in the sun. UV lights damage the skin, they damage DNA. When you get tan, that's because you have production of melanin. Melanin is produced because the sun damages your skin. It's not because it wants to make you look pretty. And what happens is that you can actually, if you don't have an efficient DNA repair mechanism, this is what happens. So this is another series of syndromes that can be caused by defects in DNA repair. Just have a look at these. I don't pretend to remember those. And then we get into genome sequencing. So we talk about mutations. Mutations are really important, but also mutations at the beginning, you cannot just simply guess where the mutations are. There are some mutations in locations that we don't know, and that's why genome sequencing is very important. So how was this initially conceived? The person called Charles Delisi at the U.S. Department of Energy wanted to map it at the beginning. And the problem is that it was extremely costly, it was like about millions and millions of dollars, and politics was a real problem. They said that that was not important, that would have been just a big waste of money, that would have never been useful to science, would never be useful to medicine, and so on. Then in 1991, Craig Venter invented the so-called ESP, so extra sequence tag. Basically, you have lots of small tags that allow you to amplify different regions. You look at where those bind, and that allows you to quickly identify where genes are. And in 98, then he founded Cellular Genomics, and in 2000, they first sequenced the Drosophila genome with shotgun sequence, so sequencing very small little regions and then putting them all together. So if you look at the cost, this is a Moore's law that describes what the hypothetical cost should be based on the advancement technology that we had in 2001. But you know, this is pretty much where it's going. It's actually lower than that. We are down here right now. We are very close to the we are at the $1,000 genome. If you run, for example, samples here, you run RNA-seq experiments, that's still about $800 per sample. If you run whole exome sequencing, that's again about pretty much the same cost. If you run whole genome sequencing, that's actually more expensive. But the main part of that comes also down to when you analyze it. So when you analyze data, you need people to spend hours and hours writing or running algorithms. You need to run these things on a server because no computer you guys have is powerful enough to handle those things. And that's going to be really one of the key challenges for the future. Find a way to store more efficiently this data. We know how to analyze them, we know what to do, but we don't know how to store them yet. So anyway, by the Cancer Genome Project, have you guys ever heard of the TCGA? Yes? No? Raise your hand if you did. Right. So the TCGA was an international, was an effort that was part of the International Cancer Genome Consortium to sequence a number of different tumors in order to understand how disease progresses, how is it formed, how we can identify new drugs to treat that. And this is a snapshot of the kind of tumors that they studied so far. They have anywhere from RNA sequencing, exome sequencing, SNP arrays, so that gives you transcription, that gives you mutations in the transcription, in the transcribed regions, it gives you copy number variations, it gives you they also have metabolomic data, so it tells you how DNA is methylated, therefore how that influences gene transcription. It tries to give you a multidimensional view on how genes are regulated inside tumor cells. And if you look then at how those data are analyzed, I mean, it's you start from millions of data points. And when you run genomic data or it can be anything between gene transcription to RNA-seq to whole exome sequencing or so on, you get a number of reads. Reads are just simply a bunch of stretches of nucleotides that have been read on your samples. And those are literally the order of millions. That's why files are so big. And then you, by filtering them down, by mapping them, by understanding what they do, by annotating them, by see if some of those are really important, you might go down to either finding nothing or finding a handful of those that can be important for your study. So the frequencies in mutations in cancer can vary. So they can be either about one base substitution per exome, like in some pediatric cancer, or thousands of mutations per exome, like lung cancer or melanoma. Now, if we think about this for a second, there is a different variety between, diversity between the number of mutations that you can find in one cancer or another one. And we know that places like the lungs or the skin tend to have a lot. So why do you think that is? Right. Like
the
right. So that's correct. So all epithelial cancer that are somehow in contact with the outside have a higher rate of mutation because of that. And there is actually an interesting correlation that I don't have here now, where the higher the number of mutation is, the longer is the progression-free survival or overall survival that you have. And the lower is the number of mutations you have, the worse those patients are going to do. So if you take, let's say, a group of patients with ovarian cancer, that because I have the data upstairs, and you divide them, you count how many mutations they have. Let's say you have 100 patients, and for each patient, I count how many mutations they have. Then you take patients that are in the top percentile, patients that are in the bottom percentile. And then you look at their survival, and you look at that in two ways. Either overall survival, so I die, and progression-free survival. So I'm cured, and then when a tumor recurs. You will see that patients that have lower mutations actually do worse than patients that have a higher number of mutations. Now this goes slightly beyond what we're discussing, but since we touched on it, I'm going to ask you why you think that is. Any immunologists in the room? Raise your hand if you work in immunology. Hi, how are you?
Good.
So why do you think that is? The other way around. So if you have higher mutational load, you tend to do better than if you have a lower.
So
yep.
You're talking
about neoantigen set? I'm sorry, can you speak a little bit louder?
If you have a higher mutational load, you're saying that's correlated with better outcomes for the patient.
That is correct.
What I think of is that these mutations are preferring neoantigens. So it's more mutations, you get a more immunogenic tumor.
Right. That's correct. So, although the number of neoantigens and this is demonstrating that those neoantigens are really reactive, it's pretty hard to demonstrate, but we know that higher neoantigen load corresponds to better response because you have higher tumor infiltration. You have higher immunogenicity, those tumors are more immunogenic. And sometimes it correlates also with higher tumor infiltration, therefore better activity of the immune system. It's funny because this is actually the opposite of what you would expect. Because you think that there are fewer mutations, therefore it's not so bad, therefore I should do better, but it's actually the reverse. Is that true for every tumor? I don't know, but for some that we actually analyzed, it is. And those data actually come from the Cancer Genome Atlas. So if you guys want to play with that, the data are available online. Anyway, so mutations, SNPs. SNPs stay for single nucleotide polymorphism, everybody knows that, and the variation occurs in about 1% of the population. You can study those by doing GWAS studies, and basically you find a statistical association between a variant and the development of disease or a phenotype. And keep in mind that correlation does not mean causality. I had an interesting Facebook conversation with a person who was convinced that vaccines cause autism, and because they said the number of vaccines increased and the number of people with autism increased. And it's very hard sometimes to convince people that those two, correlation and causation, are two different things. So don't confuse that. And one of the things that are important to remember when you study SNPs is linkage disequilibrium. So the reason why that is important when we study chromosomes, DNA, and so on, is that when you have multiple SNPs, multiple variations, so say multiple mutations, that are close to each other, those tend to be inherited together. So that means that if I analyze let's say I have a SNP array, one mutation that is part of a block of mutations, then I can infer with some statistical studies that when you it's called imputation, when you have this mutation here, then most likely you will also have this NIP, this NIP, this NIP, and this NIP. And there are numbers that can come up and tell you how statistical it is. And there are, you know, tools you can use to do this imputation. But it's very important because it allows you to understand how genetic variation can affect outcomes. Because if the one I study, if the SNP I study is not associated with an outcome, but the one that is in linkage disequilibrium with that is, then that gives an answer. And when we move from one single nucleotide to a wider region, then we can see something like this. So here is our mutation, and this is our chromosome. And if I try to analyze that, and then I find that actually some regions are missing in my sample analyzed compared to the control, that means I actually have a deletion. So a part of the chromosome has been cut out. If instead I see nothing, that means that probably both alleles have been cut out. And if instead I see lots more than that, then you have, again, so you have an amplification, so a region of your chromosome has been duplicated. If instead you see some things that shouldn't be there, that means that those area belong to another chromosome, you have a translocation. So let me explain a little bit what those are. So those are reads from sequencing analysis, and those orange regions are regions that belong to this chromosome. Those blue regions are regions that belong to that chromosome. So if I read part of that and inside the same read, I have both part from this chromosome and part from this chromosome, it means that I have something else attached to it that shouldn't be there. So it means that I have a translocation. And sometimes you find non-human sequences like viruses or different other pathogens. And that's actually part of the human reference genome. So if we look at how data actually look, this is how they look. This is a probably data from a SNP array, and you look at copy number variation. So this is a log 2 of the number of alleles. So here it means basically there's a deploy situation, there is no change. If you have a duplication, you will see a pattern like this, like here for example. If you have a deletion, you will see a pattern like this one, where it's lower. And if you have a homozygous deletion, this is what you will see, where both copy of the alleles are being cut out. And this one doesn't work either. Nope. All right. So this, don't worry about this one, this just shows you that sometimes you have very rare variants that have a very strong phenotypical effect, and you have very common variants that are correlated with that but without certainty. This is to kind of wrap it up. So DNA is packed and retired into chromosomes. You have several regions that are open at the same moment to start DNA replication. And DNA replication is not perfect, and you have mutations, and that's why you need an efficient repair mechanism. And then, thanks to current sequencing technologies, we can profile all of those variations and do some interesting study to associate them with the presence of a disease. So, transcription. If you take, you isolate DNA from my hair, a fingernail, skin, saliva, whatever, gut, the DNA sequence by itself is the same, doesn't change. However, why do I have some cells that became hair, some that became skin, some that became intestines, some that became, muscles rather than bones, and so on? Well, that's because there is a certain transcriptional program that shuts off certain genes and allows some others to be transcribed. I think everybody knows this one, so I'm going to go through that just very quickly. You have RNA polyp complex, you have your nice DNA, exon and introns. Introns are cut out, you have your exons, and then you have, depending from the reading frame, you have ribosomes that come in and produce your proteins. So the difference between DNA and RNA, you know that instead of having, you have a ribose sugar, but also instead of having thymine, you have uracil. And that's the difference in this residue down here. So this is a little bit more interesting stuff. So how does transcription actually happen? You need a number of elements to have that to work. You need a promoter that contains enhancers and silencers. You need TSS, transcriptional start site, TSS. You need POL2, regulatory complexes, histone mods, and DNA methylation, and we touched on this earlier. So this is an example of a promoter. The green parts here indicate enhancers, so the promote transcription that allow it to happen, and the red parts here, they are silencers. And also you have a TATA box, this is the part where transcription factors in POL2 prime before the TSS, and a promote transcription. However, this is not a linear process, so does not happen, the confirmation of this is not linear, so it does not happen like this. So you have stuff looping over, and it looks more like this. So you have regions that from the outside, from far away, let's say, they can loop over, bind to a mediator complex that tells to the POL2, hey, this stuff is actually binding here, it should start transcription, and that's how it happens. Your TATA binding proteins and the DNA helicases and different transcription factors all group together, and that's what allows transcription to happen. Once transcription happens, though, that's actually pretty fast. So those are results I found from a paper, and it's about a 1,000 to 4,000 base pair per minute. And if you think about, if you try to count until, 200 in a minute, that's going to be pretty fast. So that's five times faster than that. We also have a proofreading mechanism for the RNA too. And that means that when that's transcribed, there are some mistakes, and those mistakes are being corrected too. And at the end, as we have telomeres of chromosomes, we have poly A tails from RNA that prevents the RNA to be degraded and kind of directs it to where it has to go. So we have transcription factors, as you mentioned. Transcription factors moderate transcription, of course. And how does that happen? So they bind to the DNA, and they can either promote or repress transcription. They can homodimerize or they can heterodimerize. So that means they can bind to something else that is exactly the same or something else that is different. And some of those, like nuclear receptors, those are ligand-inducible transcription factors. So it means that depending on the presence or absence of ligand, they can either have a ligand-independent or dependent effect. They can either repress or de-repress genes or promote transcription. This is to give an example about the complexity of the transcriptional complexes that bind to the DNA. Up here in green, you see complexes of proteins or groups of proteins or family of proteins that promote transcriptions. Those you could call those coactivators. And those are co-repressors. So those are proteins or groups of proteins or complexes that can repress transcription. And in every single cell, there are a gazillion of those that interact together, work together, and they switch between one another in order to finely tune transcription. This is an example. So you have multiple regions here that are looping together next to the TSS, which is this black arrow up here. And all of those, if you look linearly, they're very far away. And depending from how fast also transcription has to happen, you can have different 3D conformation of the chromatin. When we talk about 3D conformation, it means that you have different regions from far away looping over and going on your region, on your TSS or genome interest. And if you look here, this is an example of an experiment called Chia PET. It's not the 3D thing that you put in your bedroom. This is actually an experiment that allows you to see how all the regions in the genome that contain a specific protein interact with each other. So this is an example with RNA POL2. And you see this region here with a peak, another one here, another one here. The arches up here indicate that there are connections, so those two regions are looping over. So between this region, or for example these two regions, as you can see down here. Up here is just a view of the genome of where those are. And up here, those are RNA-seq data, where you see green bars coming up. It means that those regions are being transcribed. So now those are just the raw reads. So if you look down here, keep going down, these co-occurs with presence of K4 monomethylated and K4 trimethylated. Both are indicators of markers of transcription and activation. And this region here, so presence of POL2, co-occurs also both here too, with the presence of ER-alpha. Those are MCSN cells, which is a breast cancer cell line. Now, when they look at that in K562 cells, they actually find a similar thing. So, sorry, they find a different thing. But when they validate it, they find a similar thing. So in MCF7 cells, you see the looping between the different regions they observe here, and you don't observe that in K562 cells. So this is an example of how different regions of the genome can interact and affect transcription. Therefore, there is a fine equilibrium between what's activated and what's repressed. And loss of this equilibrium can lead to inactivation of tumor suppressor genes or constitutive activation of oncogenes. And there are, therefore, epigenetic events like histomods, DNA methylation, and microRNAs that can influence the amount of transcript in your cell. Or you could have overexpression or downregulation of co-activators and co-repressors. So that means that what tells you to produce a lot or not to produce can be, you can have too much or too little. Or you can have also mutations in the promoter region, like, for example, binding regions for transcription factors. That means that the protein is not able to recognize or bind to their regions anymore. So with the advent of genomic studies, of course, everybody's trying to understand if there is a specific group of genes that cause this stuff, or if there is a group of these genes that can predict outcome, that can predict drug response, that can predict relapse, that can predict anything you want. So this is the number, I think, of papers, number of PubMed queries, number of papers that come out when you look for gene signatures. So if you look here, there was almost nothing in the 90s, and then it starts going up, 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 and I think this paper is from 2013, yeah, so this is probably much higher now. So people are trying to find lots of ways, you know, of finding out what we can look at in order to utilize this genomic data at their best. And there are different approaches, top-down and bottom-up. Actually, don't need you guys to look at these. But the main point is that you can look at a small number of genes and then expand your hypothesis on lots of others, or have a big number of genes and then narrow it down to only what's interesting. And why is that important? Well, the reason why that is important is because it goes on to the concept of personalized medicine. When we take a group of people, we want to make sure that since there will be variability between those people, that they will be able to, people at the hospital will be able to give them the right treatment for that person for the right cancer. It's something we are working towards. We're not quite there yet. But that's the whole concept. So you want to profile, see how gene networks interact, see how it's different, and see what we can do to modify that. But we don't only have lots of transcripts from one gene or mutations and so on. We also have RNA splicing. Therefore, we could have different isoforms of the same gene. If you look at this gene down here, for example, which is the alpha tropomyosin, for that encodes for genes in the muscles. Depending from the kind of splicing pattern that it has, it can encode for striated muscles, or whatever you read it, smooth muscles, fibroblasts, or brain mRNAs. So they can have different functions, and they all come from the same gene. But also they can be associated with complete opposite functions, or can be associated with the presence of cancer or not. Like FGFR2, you have one isoform that is associated with malignant transformation, a form of BCL which is anti-apoptotic, that BCL-XL, and one form of that is pro-apoptotic, which is BCL-XS. And a form of VEGF with a mutation that is anti-angiogenic, and another one that is pro-angiogenic. KLS6, which is have a physiological function, but with a deletion, with the exon cut out, with part of the exon cut out, you have a variant that is oncogenic. So that increases the complexity of what we look at when we analyze genomic data. Therefore, we have mutations, we have epigenetic, we have transcription, we have splicing, and all of those should be actually integrated in order to have a clear picture of what's going on. So we know that in case there is a mutation in DNA during DNA replication that can be identified and fixed and so on. So we have the same thing, a similar thing in the RNA, for the RNA. Let's say there is an error and that introduces a premature stop codon. This is our mRNA molecule in the poly A tail. Now, in case this is not triggered, so in case this is not recognized, your ribosomes will not keep, let's say, reading it and producing proteins, so attaching amino acids. And you will add at the end, you have a DNA truncated protein that you could get, it could lead, and this could lead to alter phenotype or even cancer or malignant transformation. In case that is triggered instead, in case it is triggered, then there is a complex, which is a degradation machinery, so the whole mechanism is called non-sensitivity decay, that causes that mRNA molecule to be cut down. And, oh man, I'm not sure if this works. All right, I give up. And another example of that, it's another example of fixing errors in mRNA, present in mRNA transcript, involves the utilization of a pioneer run of translation. So there are proteins that are able to go, let's say, a little bit more upstream from where the protein is being translated, and they try to detect if there is an error or a mistake, or if there is an error, especially in the exon junction complex. So that leads again to mRNA degradation. This is an example of the different combination of triplets and nucleotides that can be mutated and how that can change the final amino acids. I don't need to remember those, but just be mindful of it. And also we have microRNA, so that's another level of regulation. Do you guys have a specific lecture about this? No? All right. So those are small oligonucleotides that are able to bind to a complementary region of DNA and trigger generally degradation or they bleed into something called T-bodies, and then the RNA is not utilized for producing proteins. But the whole goal of this is to reduce the levels of transcript and therefore reducing the level of protein transcription, protein translation. And here we get into the ENCODE project, where they looked at all of these things together. They looked at, those are 3D conformations, they look at regions of the genome that are open or closed, they looked at where proteins bind in the genome, they did predictions on where the promoters are, and if some regions are enhancers or repressors, or repressing regions. They did RNA-seq, so they look at how much of a certain transcript is there, and then they put everything together. And this is an example of the analysis they did. They did this co-association matrix. I think it's a correlation matrix between the expression levels of different transcription factors. And there are a number of clusters that they pulled out of this matrix. What basically tells is that when you see a certain transcription factor that is highly expressed, you're likely to have another transcription factor that is expressed with it. And therefore, they could together influence gene expression. And you can get a visual snapshot on the UCSC genome browsers. Do you guys ever use the UCSC genome browser? Yeah? Some yes, some no? Okay. So what that is, that's a website. You can go in there and it tells you where genes are. It tells you which data sets are available that you could add to the gene you're interested in so that you can see how those genes are regulated or how those genes are conserved and so on. This is an example. You can see layer H3K27 acetylation here. So the higher it is, the more you have. This is a bit shorter scale, so this goes even higher. And H3K27 acetylation is a marker for transcriptional activation. So this is P21 genes, CDKN1A. see this corresponds to the TSS, and through the TSS, and you have different pixels, so intergenic. This is DNS clusters. So the darker it is, the more open the gene is. The DNA region is. So that means that that region is actually this region is actually accessible to transcription factors. And as you can see here, the darker it is, the more transcription factor binding you have. Here is chip analysis, probably ChIP-seq, and it tells you that the darker it is, the more of these markers in that region. And you see it piles up really well. This is an example of DNA methylation. I don't remember which one is which, but basically either blue or yellow indicates higher or lower methylation, so you're able to see how that distributes and fits with the location of your exons. This is conservation, so you have also a number of different tracks. But if you want to look at what the chromatin status is of a certain gene, if you want to look at how the gene is regulated, if you want to see if there are any alterations in that specific DNA sequence that are known to correlate with clinical outcome, this is a good place to start. And let's try. Yeah, nothing. All right, this was a nice explanation of the ANCHOR project. So, to sum this up, RNAPOL2, together with a cohort of transcription factors, synthesizes RNA molecules. RNA splicing produces the final template for translation, and splicing defects can lead to cancer. You know that. Perfectly functioning transcription machinery is key for healthy cells. And the loss of equilibrium between transcription and activation and repression can alter the physiological function of your cells, of your pathway, or different pathways, therefore leading to cancer. So, last part, and then we're done. Translation. Of course, this is the process that leads to the creation of proteins and production of proteins. You guys know that. That's mediated by a ribosome complex that is made by two subunits, 60 and 40S. Those are like the factories where the proteins are created. And how does it work? So you have, this is made of RNA, so you have, it's called tRNAs. These are oligonucleotides that are about 70 or 80 nucleotides long. In the part in the red here that are highlighted, this is where you have your amino acid that attaches to it. And the part down here is the part that actually is the anticodon loop, and that reads what's on the mRNA molecule. So how does it work? Is this one, this is your ribosome complex, these are your tRNAs, and they have a specific sequence. If that specific sequence is complementary to what's written on the RNA, then you will have a transfer of the amino acid onto the nascent protein. And this happens by reading nucleotides three at a time. So if you look at all the combinations of the various nucleotides, you will notice that the numbers are a little bit off with the number of amino acids. So that means that you have a degenerate code. So it means multiple triplets can code for the same one. So if you have sometimes a mutation in a nucleotide, that can be silent because it will not affect the outcome. And and here is kind of summarized the numbers. So if you have a triplet with four possibility per each position, you have 64 possible amino acids, but only 20 amino acids out of it. I don't know which is, I'm not going to even try. So when you have an mRNA molecule, you don't only have the part that is transcribed, and you don't only have the poly A. You have other regions that are called 5' prime and 3' prime UTR. And what they mainly do, they direct translation, and they help stabilizing the RNA molecule. For example, regions in the 3' UTR affect the poly A signal. They help directing the mRNA molecules where it should go. There are microRNA binding sites, and this is useful because it allows to the creation of the first codon, contains the first codon. What those regions are, they're about anywhere from 200 to 2,000 base pairs long. And the depending from the GC content, it can affect the stability and the stability of the mRNA molecules. They contain something called IRES, which is an internal ribosome entry site, which is where the 40S subunit binds. And they're able also to influence the secondary structure of the mRNA molecule. Depending from that, that can be easier or harder for the ribosomes to bind. And if they contain mutations, that of course can influence various functions as indicated down here. And this is just a summary of some of the phenotypical effect that you could have, or clinical effect they could have in case you have mutation of 5' or 3' UTR. There is also something called upstream ORF. That's something that is present in many eukaryotic genes, and it's juxtaposed from the original ORF operating frame. What it does, that controls DNA, that controls translation by taking out basically the ribosomes that get off earlier from the mRNA molecule, and they cause a non-mediated non-sense-mediated decay. Mutations in these regions actually lead to aberrant translations and upregulations of proteins, while the mutations in here actually decrease translation, like the CDK and 2A genes for some patients in melanoma. But actually the interesting part is this one here. So if you have, this is a condition called complete alopecia. This is observed in patients that have a mutation in the upstream open reading flame that flanks the hairless gene, and they basically cause this hereditary hypertrichosis, and the phenotypical effect is complete alopecia both in humans and in mice. So mRNA is translated to proteins following a strict code. The rate of translation is regulated by cis and trans element. And deregulation of translation can lead to several diseases and increase cancer susceptibility. So this one kind of sums everything up. So if you look at the chromosome structure, there are a number of things in there that regulate all the downstream effects. You have some elements that can move around, that can be mutated, that can be transposed, that can be rearranged. You can have duplications, deletions, you can have changes, that's called a substitution. And depending from whatever happens, what happens downstream, you could also have mutations in epigenetic marks that change the way in which the DNA is used. Therefore, that will affect DNA transcription, it can affect isoforms, it can create or be affected by non-coding RNAs like microRNAs. And this itself then causes changes at the protein levels, or truncated proteins can actually alter the way the DNA binding complex affect DNA transcription or replication or physiological pathways, therefore leading to alter metabolic or signaling pathways. This is kind of like a loop, so everything keeps a feed forward, or it keeps happening in a feed forward loop. And then you have natural selection, so cells that are able to survive there will keep proliferating, and because that mutation gave them a survival advantage. And as you mentioned before, there are some conditions that can affect them and cause all of this to be deregulated. So a key part is actually trying to understand how all of this is working and how we can target these in order to improve patient outcome. And that's it. If you have any question, raise your hand, come here, send me an email, and I will try my best to answer. Thank you, guys. Feel free to go.